Okay, well, let's get this started. I'm Phil Terone. I'll talk a little bit about how I came into the maker world in a bit, but I wanted these folks who have three interesting stories over the course of 10 years and what this thing called make and making is. It's not the first time people have made things, for sure. Because I know that always comes up. It's like, oh, people were making things in the 50s and, you know, whatever. We've been making things since the dawn of time. This is specifically the last 10 years or so of something called Make with Make Magazine and Maker Faire. So, who are you?
Lady Ada. Hi, I'm Lamore Freed, Lady Ada. So I'm an engineer and I have a company here in New York called Adafruit. We'll talk more about that in a little bit. Next up.
Mitch Altman, and probably best known for inventing TV Gone, a keychain that turns off TVs in public places, and also a co-founder of one of the early hackerspaces in the U.S., NoiseBridge.
And hello, I'm Sherry Huss, and I'm the co-founder of Maker Faire, which we started back in 2006, and very much an advocate for makers, and glad to be here today.
All right.
Hi. Yay.
Let's get it started.
Okay,
so for a really long time, I was kind of writing about this stuff. I started Hackaday, made the logo, the Hackaday site is still around. Stop by and see Hackaday. They have a booth area, and they're giving away cookies as well.
And, not poison cookies. They're tasty.
No, they're fine.
They're tasty.
I was writing for Popular Science in a new section called How 2.0, and this was like 2003, 2004 or something. And it started Hackaday. It was an offshoot of Engadget. I was the second author, and we did something called How To Tuesday, and that kind of took off, and it turned into something. It's like, oh, here, you can like put Linux on your iPod. That was back in the day when you can do that. And the tutorials became more and more popular, and it turned out the internet's a good place to put tutorials and things besides just gadget reviews. And then after Hackaday was, it was going pretty well, they were moving towards selling the entire blog network to AOL, which they eventually did. But Hackaday was unpurchasable. It was too, AOL was like, oh, this is going to be a legal nightmare. So it was the only one that kind of survived out of some of those blogs from back in the day. But I was already kind of on my way out because I'm like, okay, like that was something really neat. Wanted to start the Hackaday manifesto, and a lot of the things are still going on. The Hackaday crew that's there right now, absolutely amazing. Hackaday Prize. Check out all the things that they're up to. They even have a comic book, a lot of the cool stuff that I wanted to do. That
great
I didn't
art
get to.
From JPM,
yeah.
Too.
So O'Reilly, they always did books, and then they were going to get involved with a magazine. The CTO at O'Reilly at the time, Rael, said, oh, Dale wants to talk to you. Dale was the publisher, I think co-founder of O'Reilly, and he was publisher of like Awk and Sed. I think that was his like book that he did. Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, I want to do a magazine, and we don't know what we're going to call it yet. He said like Makers or Making, and I'm like, that's a terrible idea. Sign me up. So, because it's like a print magazine about this stuff. I remember when I started Hackaday, the feedback was there's no way you're going to be able to find a project every single day. And if you look at Hackaday right now, it's like, you know, 20, could be like 20 posts a day. It just depends on what's going on. And this is the stuff that everyone gets to. Same thing with Make. Can't believe, like, there's going to be a magazine. There's not enough people making and sharing things. But it turned out that was a good idea. So I was writing about this stuff, and then eventually, you know, full disclosure, I work with Lamore, and we're obviously partners. We did Citizen Engineer, and we've been doing stuff in the hacker world and hope for a really long time. But I stopped being able to write about it because then I was doing stuff like working in electronics and helping run a company. So it's one of those things where you don't get a chance to write about this movement. And so I thought this would be a good, like, living Wikipedia article with some of the people that you might not know their stories. A lot of people don't know that Sherry was running Maker Faire. A lot of people don't know some of the history of NoiseBridge, and a lot of people don't know where Lamore came from with electronics. So I thought I'd start with Lady Ada. And you're best known for, I think, this thing in a lot of the hacker world, right?
Yeah, this is a cell phone jammer. Okay, so here's the thing. I actually had to graduate school. I was in college. And I had to come up with a thesis project, and I actually convinced my advisor that building a cell phone jammer was a totally legit way to get my thesis. So that was pretty sweet. And so, you know, thanks to a lot of documentation online, actually, this is, you know, the project that I built for my thesis, and I published it, open source hardware. I was doing open source hardware at the time, which I'll talk about in just a little bit, because it intersects a lot with what Mitch and I were doing back in 2005. But, you know, this is something that's illegal to own, illegal to use, but it's legal to publish the documentation about. So I put this on my website and put it in my thesis, and I graduated, so that's really great. Although sometimes I have that nightmare where you like haven't graduated for some reason, like you still have some document you have to sign.
And was Adafruit a company while you were doing this, or you had not started Adafruit?
So when I first, the first, this actually version was the second revision, you can see it was at IBM. So when I started, there was no Adafruit yet. This was, I was still a student. I was at the Media Lab, and I'll actually explain how this intersects with hacking, with making. As I was working on this at the Media Lab where I was doing my thesis, there was this guy who was in a room. I was in this place called The Cube, and there was another room where this group called Center for Bits and Atoms was, and there was this grad student named Saul Griffith. And Saul Griffith was one of the people who was working with you to organize this Make a Magazine. So as I was building like cell phone jammers and you know, later TV guns and stuff, Saul would come by and say, hey, you know, that's a really cool project you're working on. You want to totally like write a bunch of articles for free for this magazine? And I was just like, yeah, sure, I'll do that. Like, why not? So that's how I got involved with Make, was actually through somebody at the Media Lab who was watching me work on this project. And when I was working on this project, I was kind of, I don't know why I thought this was a good idea, but I was like, oh, I know, I'll do a couple projects for my thesis. And I wanted to do something similar to a cell phone jammer, something that turned off cell phones, but I wanted something that would turn off televisions. And at this exact time, like literally like the same month that I was looking at how to do this, I read an article about this guy. Actually, so I'll tell you the truth. When I first read about TV gun from Cornfield Electronics, I was like, Cornfield Electronics? Like, this guy must be so boring. No, I'm so sorry. But it was like, you know what it is? It's like Cornfield. And I was like, what is this like Ohio like electronic? But so the TV gun was kind of neat because it was exactly at the same time. This is what I was saying earlier. We have these three stories and it's like those movies where there's like three different timelines at the end. It's like, oh, they're all in the same cafe together, you know? We intersected all at the same time, which is kind of a blessing. But at the time I was working on the stuff and publishing and trying to start a company making electronics, it's only like, you know, me and like a couple people in this room, so I'll just tell the truth. I was actually getting a little burnt out with the hacker scene. I spent a lot of time in the 90s and early 2000s hacker scene, and I've been to a lot of DEF CONs and summer CONs and pump CONs, and I think I was kind of ready for something new. There's absolutely nothing wrong with those conferences and the events, but it started to diverge a little bit from the stuff I was interested in. There's just like so many times you can get like really drunk in Las Vegas and do a lot of drugs. I did that. And so what I thought was interesting about Make and the magazine that came a little bit before that Ready Made was this was a different approach to the same kind of technological interest I had, right? Coding and soldering and making stuff, Burning Man projects, sharing open source. It had a lot of the same philosophies, just like a little bit less of like this really hardcore hacker scene, which I was totally part of and is like, you know, I take credit and blame for everything that, you know, I'm responsible for. But I wanted this fresh start. You know, I wanted something a little bit different. And I think Mitch, you and Sherry, you guys did such a good job at making community, you know, like when you talk about NoiseBridge, about being excellent to each other, about being inclusive, about getting different people from different parts of society in, not just hackers. There's hackers at NoiseBridge, hackers at Maker Faire, but a lot of different other people. There's crafters, people who do 3D printing, people who do robotics and CNC, kids who are learning programming, people doing wearable electronics at the wearable group at the Media Lab too. So I think that having Making as this parallel track, you can see the borrowing, right? You do, you can see Lockpick Village here. There's also a Lockpick Village at DEF CON, right? You can see a Lockpick Village at Maker Faire. But the soldering workshops that you've done actually started to leak into hacker conferences, hacker scene. Like, there never used to be big soldering workshops, and now there are. So I think there's been a lot of really good cross-pollination between the groups.
Okay, so cell phone jammer, and then Adafruit. Before that, though, this was the first time that people were starting to share electronics and putting a software license.
Yes.
That seems to be an ingredient in the maker world, because that's kind of what will be the next part of the story with Mitch and TV Be Gone, which wasn't an open source thing. That was really scary. But where did that come from? Was it just you? Was it a group of people?
So having been in like, you know, this Boston hacker scene, Boston of course has, you know, the FSF, FSF at the time there was EFF, I think had just moved to California. There was this, at MIT, which where I was, there was a culture of, you know, open source. We have a license, MIT license, you know, it's the best license. And so, you know, we just loved bike shedding about license. We're like, let's bring this to hardware. But Saul Griffith, that student, he was actually doing open source hardware with Kite Design at the time. And so I thought that was very interesting, right? Mm. He's taking the idea of publishing Kite CAD files under open source license so people can hack and, you know, revise kite surfing kites. And at the time, people were publishing open source hardware in the sense that they were publishing schematics. Obviously, like, I did not come up with this idea, right? Anyone who's opened an Apple II manual comes with schematics. But the idea of trying to get the circuit board designs up online, the bill of materials up online, and the CAD files, and having those under an open source license was a little bit new. And again, like, we know licensing, we just said, like, I don't know, Creative Commons, like, what the fuck? Like, we, you know, it doesn't even apply. Like, we still don't know, right, because it's never been to court. So who knows whether any of this even makes sense. But we wanted to get our idea. We wanted to distribute this hardware and tell people what we expected from it, from people using it, and give people more rights than they might think. Like, some people may not realize, no, it's okay, you can make a company out of it, like you did with TVBGod, or you can sell stuff. And people in the maker community, a lot of it is funded from people making kits and selling stuff through, whether it be Tindy or Kickstarter or at Maker Faire events. But it was kind of an interesting new idea, but I think it came from this hacker-coder mentality that was in Boston, started with open source software and kind of colliding with people being able to publish files online. It seemed like a natural progression.
Okay, so then you started Adafruit.
Yeah.
And you do a bunch of electronics now. Are they all still open source hardware?
Yes, everything is open source hardware that can be.
Okay.
Yay! And we've actually gotten other companies, which is kind of neat. Like, we've had chip companies who never did open source, and we kind of pressured them to do stuff open source. So it's slow, and you know, but it does work eventually. Like, people see the benefit.
Yeah, it seems to be the standard now. Like, Arduino, if they release a board, the expectation is there's the schematics, there's the source code for it, there's an open source license.
Yes, this was not normal at the time. Yeah. I mean, there was documentation, but nothing was available open source. I think that, yeah, having about 2006 or so, with a large proliferation of open source hardware projects, it became a natural thing for people to do. I also think people noticed how you could do open source hardware and that wasn't the reason your business or project failed, right? It failed for maybe other reasons, but it was rarely because you put something under an open source license. I think people were scared of that. Once they saw, like, oh, wait, there's a group of people doing this, it's working out, join in the party.
And as far as giving all this stuff away, so Adafruit is still loan-free, venture capital-free, profitable, manufactures electronics in the USA and New York City.
These are my machines.
Yeah.
These are my pet machines. I love these machines. I pretty much did this just so I could buy these machines. They're pretty sweet. There's two pick-in places, a stencil and an oven. So it's a full pick-and-place line here in New York where we do our manufacturing.
Here's some of our folks. We have healthcare and 401k and paid time off for charity and Mother's Room. We're giving off.
I'm wearing my EFF shirt, so I'm representing.
Yep. And
we're a New York company, and you know, we are all New Yorkers, and it's been an adventure over the last 10 years. We have, you know, 120, 130 people together. Doing things as a team is pretty exciting. I think, you know, a lot of hackers and makers have gone on to start companies, so you know it's a challenge taking the stuff in your brain, making it real, and then working with all these people to make it happen. But we have really great people, so it's pretty easy. Yeah. My job's easy.
And one thing that I thought that would be neat to do, so when you have a company or a community or products, you know, sometimes you get copied, and that could be really good. So we're working with our employment lawyer, and we're going to give a paid day off for Election Day this year as a company benefit.
It should be a federal holiday, right?
And, yeah. So.
But until it is.
So Adafruit did paid time off for charity so that employees can do any type of 501(c) charity. It's not the founder's only charity. Sometimes company owners kind of force everyone to like whatever they like. This is for the employees to do whatever they want. So. Part of this, I wanted to kind of seep in some ideas for building communities. The maker movement is a movement. We're all getting older, so like someone has to keep carrying us on. But that's just one thing that you can do. If you put out your schematics and your source code, it's a good thing for it to be copied. If you talk about how some of your businesses run and it's good, that could be copied. Some things you'll hear about workshops and hacker spaces and maker fairs with millions of people, there's some good things to copy with that.
Okay, so enough about me. Time to talk about Mitch.
So Mitch, when I met you, you had a closed source TV Be Gone. And I remember, I think you were doing the radio show. You were doing Off the Hook. And you knew, and you were in the hope world, or right? Like, I think that's...
Yeah, you tell us.
Yeah, well, you know, I've been a geek all my life, and eventually I was able to call myself an inventor, which was a scary move, probably when I was in grad school and made a music synthesizer as my master's thesis. And I was like, I guess I'm an inventor. My brother is a patent lawyer, so... back then, there was no such thing as open hardware. It's just what one did. No one even thought about this stuff. And then I invented TV Be Gone. It turned out a lot of people thought it was cool to turn TVs off. Who knew? And so since I had experience with manufacturing at previous jobs, which were a terrible idea, the job, not the manufacturing, and so I had to extricate myself and hire three people to replace all the responsibilities that I had. And then I was free.
I have a question. Were you attending conferences like Hope and doing Off the Hook before you did TV Be Gone, or that, like, what's the time?
No. Okay. So this was when I did TV Be Gone. It was 2003, and then I started manufacturing it because people wanted it, and then it was an overnight hit, and it changed my life forever. And I got calls from all these totally bizarre, weird, cool people, including someone who's a Hope organizer, Bernie S. And he ordered a box to give away to friends, and he said, "Hey, you know, you should come to this thing. It's a hacker conference." I was like, "Hacker, you know that word?" And then you're, you know, what the hell is that? But I looked into it, and it wasn't what the mainstream media said—people breaking into computers and stealing stuff. It was people coming together to share and learn and teach, and you know, and like it's, you know, community. And like, I'm a geek, and I was like excluded from community growing up, and so it sounded like, well, it was scary. I'm an introverted geek, but okay. And so I came here, and it changed my life forever. You know, first time in my life where I felt at home in a group. It was. I almost cried. It was amazing. And but before that, I was looking online for something TV Be Gone related, and I came across someone who I'd never heard of, who had a master's thesis that had this thing that was glasses that would turn opaque whenever a TV became into the field of view. It turned out to be L'Amour.
It's very foreshadowing.
And I'm like, this is awesome. I have to contact this person. So I did, and we emailed a bunch back and forth. And it seemed really cool. So, but I didn't know if we'd ever meet. But in 2006, L'Amour emailed me and said, "Hey, we're going to be in San Francisco to go to this maker fair." I'm like, what the hell is a maker fair?
I looked online
about that, and then it was Make Magazine. It had been around for a year, and like, why haven't I heard about this? Well, it's because I've been like going like crazy, hardly getting any sleep, trying to keep up with all this stuff for TV Be Gone. But I went, and that's where I met L'Amour and Phil, and I think Sherry, if not the second maker fair. And you know, that was another life-changing event where there's all these people sharing their cool projects openly with one another, and people wanted to learn about mine. I wanted to learn about everyone else's, and yet no one was making anything. It was a maker fair, and maybe they were, but I didn't see it. And then Hope was just a little bit later, and no one was making anything here, so I was like, hell, I'm going to teach soldering. I love doing that. And that was 10 soldering irons, and it was mobbed, and it just kind of grew from there, event to event. But it also changed my life because you know, back then there really wasn't open hardware to speak of, and my brother's a patent lawyer, and that's what one does. You know, you're an inventor, you invent something, you patent it. And at these hacker conferences, and especially the third one I went to, or the second one I went to, which was in Germany, put on by the CCC, people were enthusiastic about my project, but they're like, what about this patent thing? Why are you keeping people from learning from and using your technology? It's not your technology. You put it out in the world. It should be shared with everyone. Why should it be blocked? And I'm like, well...
That's a really good impression of, like, the CCC. Good work.
I could put on a German accent. Yeah. But no, I'm learning German. I love it over there, and I love the CCC and this, and I want... And we're sharing even more and more as time goes on. It got me to think, even as I'm thinking, well, you know, I put a year and a half of my life into making this thing. What if someone took it and just made it and sold it and I'd get nothing from it? And I'm thinking, but why did I do this? I'm doing this because I want to help put a tool into the world that'll help people turn TVs off. And if it's patented and someone else does it cheaper and better, more people will be doing it. And that's why I'm doing this to begin with. And it turned out, and then meeting Lamour, and Lamour was like, totally, everything must be open source.
Yeah,
and then,
I'll give you my version. So Mitch was in San Francisco. Lamour was going to Maker Faire in San Francisco. So I invited them both out to dinner. And I spent the entire night just convincing Mitch to do a kit version of TV Be Gone. I'm just like, no, this is going to work out. And it was peak TV Be Gone. And he thought it was a good idea and agreed. Now, just imagine that. That was all of your livelihood, all your income. And in one dinner after chatting with each other, you decided to completely open source it and do a kit.
It made sense.
And and that unlocked what you wanted to do, which is eventually to do workshops, because you would go and build these.
Yeah, and then teaching soldering, I needed a kit to do it, and this is the first kit, along with your mini POV, which was, what, your first kit?
Yes, the product number one was the mini POV. But this was like product number seven. It was very early, very early on. I really loved it.
Here's a question. If you didn't do this kit, what would have happened if you just stuck to selling this? Where would you be right now?
My life wouldn't have... I wouldn't be here. The whole reason that I'm still making a living 15 years later on this project that I just made for me and turned out to be popular is because it's open source. Because I'm just a small company. Me and 12 friends have made a living from this because it's open source. I can't afford lots and lots of PR, but when someone makes this or they download the plans and make their own version, I don't get a cent. You don't get a cent if they're not buying this kit. But they tell everyone they know that they built this thing that just really, look, it turns off TVs and watch this. And then they talk about TV Be Gone, and then way more people buy my thing or this kit or whatever, and people find out about my company, about Adafruit, about the whole scene. And I can't afford that kind of PR.
And then they take it to CES.
I don't know anything about that.
So someone brought a TV Gone kit when it was brand new to CES and video turning off.
Yeah, I don't know any.
And that got me.
The secret behind that is
I
soldered up five of them and I overnighted them to one of the Gizmodo authors. And
they don't care at all.
He got kicked out and he turned off all the TVs. And it was interesting, all the coverage and outrage. One person somewhere, they kind of followed the money. They're like, you know, that kit's available from MakerShed and Adafruit. And they're like, I think this guy Phil did that. I think he...
There's like this one lone comment in like some...
Out of all the outrage, it was one little line. You're like, I think they probably had a top sales day for that kit.
They did.
I did. For my TV Be Gone. I got $24,000 of sales in 12 hours
of
their two-minute video. But this is the same organization that on the first day of sales of TV Be Gone, the keychain version, the original one, the Gizmodo person started off an article saying, Mitch Altman is an asshole. And not just any kind of an asshole, and it goes off. And that got me like $30,000 in a day. So.
You actually like drank the hater. It's true.
So you spend a lot of your time doing workshops, and then I think the other thing, and this is how all this starts to come together. There wasn't things called hacker spaces in the same way till you came along. I think it was more of a European thing. There was one over there, but then you decided to do a hacker space. Now there's maker spaces. Why did you do that?
Yeah, well, going to Hope and feeling like home in a group for the first time after being excluded from community all my life is like, this is awesome. I want more of this. And but then the conference ends, and then I was like, oh, but there's this one in Germany, and then I go there, and it was like, wow, this is great. And then it ends, and I want more. And my third one, also in Germany, there were people talking about how to start your own hackerspace. I was like, hell, if there's a hackerspace in my hometown, I don't have to wait till the next hacker conference. There can be community that I feel a part of in my hometown where we teach, share, and do all this cool stuff that we do here. And so there were a bunch of us in Germany who got together when we got home in San Francisco. And we also encouraged each other from New York and Washington, D.C., folks who later started New York, our NYC Resistor and HackDC. Mm-hmm. And we started three of the early hackerspaces in the U.S., modeled after this way open, inclusive, very diverse groups that come together in mostly Germany and all over Europe. And we did. By 2008, there were these hackerspaces in the U.S., and everyone was watching us, and it was amazing, and people are coming and visiting. It's like, how can we do this? And so we started with the help of people in MetaLab in Austria, and some other folks started hackerspaces.org, where people could collaborate and network, and it started proliferating. Within a year, there were 100 more around the U.S., a bunch more in Europe. And within a year after that, there were 500 more. And it's been growing pretty much exponentially ever since. And I go all over the world doing workshops, and hackerspaces are a great place to do workshops. And it really worked well as far as just making a living as well, and open source and sharing all these things, and kits from other people who make open source, teaching people to solder, teaching electronics. But people find out about my livelihood, TV Be Gone, which they like, and they're supporting me doing that, so it's a more publicity. It all feeds in on itself. And I didn't really talk much about Maker Faires. At the early days, the second Maker Faire, I'm doing workshops there, and that one slide that went by with, I think it was 83 years old. Yeah,
this guy. Mm-hmm.
He was amazing, and he'd never made anything in his life. And he was totally into it. And, you know, but kids come in all sizes and ages, and it's totally fun doing this. Maker Faire was also a huge thing where I could make and also sell kits, but you know, the first kit's cheap. but you know, it's infectious. I've met people at Maker Faire and also hacker conferences who they've never made anything, and I don't know what this man did afterwards, but people have come to me who are little kids later, and now they're making a living in electronics, and I taught them how to solder, and like, that's the most amazing, gratifying feeling ever.
Yeah, in our timeline, 10-year-old kids, when they went to the first Maker Faire, are now like 25 or something. You know, like, that's weird, because for us, we're all kind of the same, but they're like a whole new double-sized human, had a full life. But for us, we're just a little grayer. So that brings us to Maker Faire. This seems like it's built on top of all, you know, the previous two folks here, Lady Ada and Mitch. So what is it, like Burning Man? Like, what is this thing?
No, I mean, it has a spirit of Burning Man for sure. But in the sense that it's community, it's sharing, it's teaching people, and it's having fun. You know, I think the most wonderful thing about Maker Faire is that just all types of people come together, and the, you know, the currency is ideas, and there's a generosity of spirit that I don't think you find anywhere else. So it's really anywhere else in a big community environment like that. But you know, I would say Maker Faire, you know, for the past 13 years have really been out there in the community trying to pull people together, convincing people that yes, you're a maker. You might do bobbin lace making, you might do, you know, robots, you might do, doesn't matter, you might do large scale art objects, but it doesn't matter, you share the same passion about people, community, spirit, materials, and open source. And I'll say when we started Maker Faire, I mean, my background was primarily in book publishing, software publishing. I got into events after coming from Ziff Davis in the magazine, where I was studying online communities, which at that time, online communities really weren't that interesting. You know, it was AOL, Prodigy, CompuServe. It's, you know, great, we're going to have a, you know, a forum or a chat. My first event was Java 1, and I have to say it was really wonderful to kind of come together and really figure out what makes developers different and how to attract and how to get them going. And it was like food and music and gaming and different things that I was able to infuse in that. And through that event world, I really then came to kind of the open source world, which I have to say was wild and wonderful. And, you know, I was at Ziff Davis where everything was closed and proprietary, as was Sun, as was Oracle, as was Microsoft. So having this liberation and freedom to say, wow, this is open source, and actually you can kind of share. And at the same time, different things were happening. And I think I don't know where your timeline slide is, but it was kind of a perfect storm. I mean, when did the movement start?
Well, I grabbed a couple slides here and there. I thought you could talk about how many people just last year.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean,
1.58 million people had went to a Maker Faire event.
Yeah,
and you can see the timeline at the bottom with 2006, 22,000 people.
Yep.
And then 2017, 1.5 million people.
I mean, there are two inflection periods for me. You know, the first from 2006 to 2009, honestly, it was just beating on doors, telling people they're makers, trying to get sponsors. We went to Austin for 2 years, which was wonderful. And to go and learn a new community, amazing. Like, and you know, and actually I ran into Mitch different places, I think in Glasgow and in the UK. But in 2009, we had a recession. And so that period we had to say, okay, what are we going to do? So we pulled back to one fair, the Bay Area, even though Austin, people seem to get it, but businesses and corporations just still, I don't think they really get the importance of this movement globally, but that's another story, another day. In 2009, we got a $25,000 grant from the Kauffman Foundation, and we wrote a playbook, because everyone wanted a Maker Faire. So we said, well, if we're going to do this, we're going to have to figure out, let's give the recipe and let's give license to other groups to kind of get down what's happening. So we pulled back one fair in 2009. In 2010, we expanded and we did two different models, one in New York, which we knew we needed to come to New York, and we did one in Detroit. And with Detroit, we partnered. We actually did a joint venture with the Henry Ford, and in New York, we partnered with the New York Hall of Science. Both were interesting. The New York Hall of Science has been actually an amazing partner. That event's the end of September, like the 22nd, 23rd, and honestly, they share the same passion, the same drive, the same, you know, getting kids hands-on. And Detroit was interesting, too, and in fact, Detroit's gone on to be its own license. But 2009 was important, and that's when this licensing program started. And then 2014, when we went to the White House, which, you know, I probably didn't even really appreciate it as much as I do now, because we had, fortunately, we aligned with three objectives from the White House, so veterans retraining, workforce development, and STEM education. And we had a lot of the forces, you know, in the Office of Science and Technology Policy Program, Tom Khalil's group, helping kind of infuse this out into the world. And those were really, that was important even globally. You know, as we all know, especially even after this last week, a lot of folks, a lot of countries look and see what's happening in the U.S. And
are any of those maker programs going on anymore?
Absolutely. So the two largest, you know, and again, I'm going to say Maker Faire, people, you know, you want to look at numbers, and actually this is nice hockey stick growth, but I'm going to say some of the best Maker Faire experiences are the small ones. They don't have to be big. You know, sometimes being big is more complicated, but it's good for press. But some of the small Maker Faires are really important, and they're happening all over the world, which is really wonderful. Rome, I think that they'll be on their 8th event this year. They started in 2013, so sorry, 5th.
Yeah.
6th event. And they're actually doing quite well. They worked with the European Commission, which started a European Maker Week, and I think probably Mitch, you probably have seen some of the things in Europe around there. And then Shenzhen has been really important as well, and I think many of you probably have been there. And, you know, it's actually, the other interesting thing that comes out of this is this international community that goes, you know, it's just so impactful and so powerful that you can pretty much reach out to anyone at any time of the day to actually get any answer to any question that you have solved. So this growth is, it's interesting. It's going to be, you know, where does it go from here? And, you know, that's going to be the next step. And Maker Faires, I mean, it's interesting, Cornfield Electronics. I came from Ohio, so I modeled Maker Faire after the Lorain County Fair because I love going to the fair as a child. Like, once, you know, once a year in the summer, you see things, and I think that that's what's so wonderful about the kids, any age, that come to a Maker Faire. It's just that it gives them ideas, and they can hope, and they can dream, and you know, they can go home and mash things up, and you know, probably for a week or two, it's pretty crazy around their house, as they're looking for more things to do around the year. And I think kind of year-round making and programming and getting it into schools is also another real key thing. So.
And so for over 10 years, you ran these Maker Faires, put together the
everything.
Things.
You know, actually for 13 years straight, I thought about it 24/7. You know, how are we going to grow it? How are we going to push it? How are we going to include communities? Getting more women, getting more diverse groups involved in making has always been the first year. Actually, we did have making the first year. We had Wendy Tremaine with Swaparamarama, which was probably the smartest thing we ever did, which to get families. I mean, we made some assumptions that a maker, you know, and most of Make's audience at that time, and we started Maker Faire for a festival to celebrate makers. Most of its audience at that time was male. And what we really wanted to do was say, well, you know, these males probably have families, and those families probably care about the same things that might manifest in a different format. So, you know, 13 years later, here we are.
Yeah, and that was one of the reasons when we put together the text for this panel. I was getting nervous that you were getting erased out of the maker movement. Sherry, because there's these books that come out, Maker Manifesto, Maker This, there's like five different magazines that have the word make in it now.
Yep.
And I kept seeing Father of the Maker Movement, all these, you know, I was around the beginning, like all these things, but I didn't see your name anywhere. So I just wanted to say thank you, Sherry, for all of the Maker Faires for the last 13 years. And
they just sort of happen, but it's this intense, amazing amounts of work and organization that you and your team have done. It's,
no, absolutely. And, you know, and I didn't do it alone. I mean, certainly Louise Glasgow, who is our show producer, has been there from the beginning. Bridget Vanderlyn was there from the beginning doing community and programming, and Jonathan, and the list goes on and on. It's certainly, it's an effort that involves a lot of folks, but it's finding like the potential. It's finding, you know, the seeds in the community. I don't know if Nick Normal's here, but Nick was actually one of our first community evangelists to go out and actually find makers and tell people, yeah, you're a maker, you know, and a lot of times it's just really telling people and giving them permission to say, yeah, you're a maker. You didn't have to go to college, you didn't have to do anything, you just have to be passionate about something and willing to share. And so we spent a lot of time kind of heads down and literally 24/7 for sure. It's great. And actually, Phil, if you go back to the Adam Savage one, I'll say Adam has also been another person, you know. It's so great. Adam comes to the Bay Area Maker Faire every Sunday. We try to, like, do something. We say he has a Sunday sermon. But here's a guy, too, that's out there just really inspiring people of all ages. And it's important.
There's a new show, Mythbusters Jr., and I'm pretty sure every single, and they're kids, and then there's Adam Savage. I'm pretty sure every single one of them is a Maker Faire kid. There's Allie.
Probably.
Yeah, they all got their start, and they've only known a world, because I think they're all under 13, they've only known a world with make and making.
And I'll tell you, we actually spent a lot of time and even money on trying to do things like recycling, and we brought in different groups, and you know, we really felt that it was important to practice what we preached. So I'm really optimistic about the kids that are coming out, you know, in their 20s right now. And I'm excited about seeing where they're going to take this and how they can make it 365 days a year.
I remember the Maker Faires, the first day was actually for schools. There was a secret day.
Yeah, we tried to do Education Day. And actually, it's really fun to watch that being kind of played out internationally. And even one of the things we do is a maker dinner. I mean, I'm so gracious for the makers that come and give their time over the weekend. They're not getting paid. They're there because they love it, and they're there because they want to share. And a very good friend of mine, Gerard, who has done paella for us in the Bay Area, and we bring him around. You know, I love seeing it like the paella version or the maker dinner version, like in Nantes, France, being played out. So some of these traditions are really important. Blue ribbons, you know, another thing, which, again, acknowledging, making sure that my team got to get out and talk to the makers. You know, again, that's one thing to do and produce the event, but, you know, stop and kind of, you know, appreciate what's happening there. So little things like blue ribbons or little acknowledgments, hence a nod back to the old county fair, kind of are really key. And again, we're all kind of people, and I don't know, it's just kind of fun. And as you probably feel just being here, talking to other people and that human side of everything is really important.
All right, and I know there's going to be questions at the end. It's 11:41, so I think we have to start up with questions, but I have some questions first. First one's for you, Mitch. I know, so NoiseBridge is getting kicked out of the current space. What type of help do you need, or what could, because this is kind of how help happens, you put a flag out and help. what could people do? Is there a fundraising thing, or is it a space thing? What do you need to keep this
yeah, more, so,
is it a historic landmark yet? I mean, I feel like it should be.
People have looked into that, but the building itself has to be the historic, and it's not an historic building, so at least in San Francisco. So that's not going to happen. But yeah, after being in our current space for 10 years, the landlord, and San Francisco's out of control.
Isn't there some billionaire that can just put it in a submarine or like a rocket or something? Like,
yeah, we can have an inappropriate submarine at NoiseBridge as well as anywhere else in the world. So
no, just every other day there's like next billionaire, like what, or, you know, everyone's... Everything's IPO. Isn't there like a scooter company that can just like help you out?
Well, if anyone knows of any millionaire scooter companies that want to help out NoiseBridge, send them our way. Just noisebridge.net has a lot of info on that. We got a reprieve. We'll get to stay in our place another year, but no matter what we do, we're going to have to double our income, and that's the most challenging thing. We're doing fundraising so we can buy a place, hopefully, so we don't have to go through this again. And but what do we do? Like, how do we stay a group that we want to be while doubling our income in order to pay for doubling our expenses? And that's an ongoing discussion that anyone can be part of, because we're an anarchist group where everyone's welcome.
Yeah, if you wanted to double your revenue, you wouldn't be a hackerspace. That's not the charter. Like, let's go make a ton of money. That would just be a company.
Yeah, we're not there to make money, but we need money for rent and for cleaning. Cleaning products for cleaning our toilets, but
so you need new space, and there's some fundraising, so people could check out NoiseBridge.
Yeah, NoiseBridge.net. That's of course the top of our page now. But you know, again, I mean, we just want to continue to be a space where people can come and teach and share and learn and be part of an open, friendly community.
Okay, so Sherry, you're out of the Microfaire game. Mm-hmm. You're done for now. Mm-hmm. You're out.
I'm kind of taking a break. I'm doing what I'm calling independent studies and working with a lot of different maker groups. So everything from drones to wearables to Gerard, helping him launch his restaurant, and just kind of taking a break to figure out where this is all going, because things are changing. I mean, I think we see that every day.
Yeah. So right now, what is the challenge for large-scale events that bring people together? Because every day is pretty much how do you divide people?
Yeah,
no, like completely. That's the game, it
completely.
Seems.
You know, for Maker Faire, it's always been kind of a sponsor. You know, it's been 50-50 kind of attendee revenue and sponsor-supported. It may make a little money, but it's, you know, nothing for the amount of work that goes into it. And usually those dollars go right back into another program. I think the big thing is getting sponsors on board or to help fund this. I mean, again, it's not a lot of money that's needed. It's the same thing that Mitch feels. This isn't huge dollars that we're looking for, but I really think getting large corporations, who, by the way, have co-opted the word maker in everything. In fact, one of my friends just showed me some pictures that I sent to the sales team on Vans shoes, said, you know, here's the shoe for a maker.
There was a Nissan commercial. It's like, you're a maker, buy a Nissan. It's
so,
like, what?
So
I swear that was the commercial. Yeah. Like you like to make, and here's the new Nissan.
Yeah.
So
it's coffee for makers. We get them in the grocery store.
Yeah. So I wish that those companies would kind of step forward and, you know, and help kind of support this, because it really is good. And again, it doesn't have to be as big, and it doesn't have to be crazy expensive. They can be in different groups, but it's important. It really is.
Okay. And then for you, Lady Ada, what are the next things that you're working on in the world of community and sharing and hardware?
I think the most interesting thing for me is just how to get more people to do what we're doing, basically cloning Adafruit to make more of them. I think it's hard to do a business, but I'd love to see more open source hardware and more makers. And I think it's neat when we see young people, you know, again, who were, when 10 years ago they were, you know, preteens, and now they're graduating with electrical engineering degrees, and hopefully they'll take the kind of values that we're sharing with the world and bring them into, you know, whether they work at a company or whether they start their own company or do consulting or stay in academia. I want to keep this meme of open source hardware and sharing hardware designs alive. I think it's never been a better time. There's so much social media, we might as well use it to share files and documentation.
You can use social media for good things?
Well, I just want to say
I've heard,
point,
I don't know.
if you have a job you don't like, quit and do something worthwhile. We have many models to draw from now.
And we're going to open up for questions now. I guess the last thing is, we are what we celebrate. And so if you're a publisher, if you're a person who just happens to be on Twitter, and like, it's not all, it doesn't have to be all for complaining and saying things are terrible. You can use it for other stuff. And if you want to see cool folks like this in the world, celebrate them. Make sure they're not erased out of history. If they have products, support them. If they have events, go to them. If they have kits, pick one up. That's the best way that we can all keep doing this. So,
But hey, Phil, before questions, yeah. I actually want to also give kudos to Phil, because Phil's worked hours and hours behind the scene. He's been a great... When I first met him, I thought, this blog thing, really? Yeah. But I've enjoyed collaborating with Phil over the years. He's got a crazy, wonderful mind. He knows how to connect with lots of different groups. And again, a lot of this is why we're all here, too, is because of you. So thank you for that,
Yay.
Phil.
Yeah. Yay!
I just work here. All right, questions.
I have two questions. I'd like your comments on either the bankruptcy of TechShop, which happened this year despite
yep.
what seems to be great increase in the population doing making, and also on the Fab Lab movement, if you have any Fab Lab consortium, if you have any comments on
that. I'll take the TechShop one. So I put on my journalist hat once in a while, and I covered that. So it seems like it was just mismanaged with all the money. They were spending more than they were making. And they opened up one in New York, and then 2 weeks later, they closed it down. And employees were told over email, I think, hey, it's closed. And so people had moved out. They moved their entire lives. I think transparency within organizations, if you work at a company and there's no way to find out how much you're spending versus how much you're making, it's not good for lots of reasons. Maybe the owners of the company are siphoning off. That happens a lot. Maybe they're not making a lot of money. Lots of... venture capital was poured in, and it was just impossible for it to make money. So for that one, it might be a good idea to do something like TechShop, and now there's another version of it that I think is open. It's like Shop Build. And who knows? But that's just to answer the question, they just spent more than they made. And eventually, like, you can't make payroll, and then it's over. For the Fab Lab movement, that's more of an academic one,
yeah.
and Lamore, that started at MIT, so Lamore probably... has some comments on that.
So remember that guy, Saul Griffith, his group, the Center for Bits and Atoms, that Professor Neil Gershenfeld was the professor who sort of started writing about and creating Fab Labs. So it's not a coincidence. The idea of maker spaces and building stuff and the stuff that's being built in Fab Labs, if you look at the documentation for Fab Labs, they use a lot of like the kits that Mitch and I designed and people at Harvard groups did, and they do Arduino and they do programming. So I think Fab Labs, again, it is a more academic. They tend to get grants to open them, but they mirror the same idea as makerspaces. They they borrow and give ideas from the community-run makerspaces. I think if you have a grant, you can open up a Fab Lab. That's amazing. You're going to get like a really sweet organization. You're going to work with schools. I think that there's also an area for community-led makerspaces that also work with schools and borrow some of the ideas of that Fab Lab, but maybe have a slightly different twist. I think some of the stuff that happens in makerspaces, like lock picking, wouldn't necessarily make it in a Fab Lab, but some things like 3D printing are in both. So it's definitely an organic give and take between making and Fab Labs.
Yeah, lots of overlap.
There's not like a competition, like who can make more. I think it's like we're doing the same thing.
Okay, next question.
I'm the father of two sons, 12 and 14, and they've participated in maker activities. And so I have to tell you, your stuff is really, really important. And my question is this: has there been any interest in looping in to the maker events, the do-it-yourself repair community, and teaching people to repair and the tools and the wherewithal of learning to repair things, whatever it may be, and also maybe even establishing like repair competitions where things are deliberately broken and you have to figure out what's wrong and fix it. I'm just wondering if there's been much interest in that area. There may be, I don't know.
There's a lot of interest in that. All over the world now, there's fix-it cafes, they're often called, and they often happen at hackerspaces, and it's promoted there. Noisebridge has a few people, but one in particular, which really pushes people to come and bring things that everyone can help each other fix it. But if you, the ideas you just brought up are great, so either go to your local hackerspace and make it happen, because that's the only way things happen, or start a hackerspace and make it happen, or just start a fix-it cafe and make it happen. Please do it. You know, you've got the energy, you've got the ideas, you can collect other people around you and make it happen.
Sherry, what was I fix-it doing stuff with Maker Faire?
You know, absolutely. I would say, you know, and actually we even started early days with something called Make Play Day, which was a take-apart electronics area, which was...
That was great.
IEEE helped and, you know, pulling in the community. And then it just became one of those things that was hard to manage. But seriously, most people have things that you could probably take apart at home anyway that aren't working. But iFixit, definitely. And I've seen internationally, too, traveling, that there's a lot of fixer collectives and that. But there could be a bigger spotlight on it. You're right about that. Sure.
Yeah, and part of it is getting consumers used to their right to repair. I mean, yeah. We're all getting told it's a black square that you can never open up. So I think all of us can make sure we get the word out that it's not only is it good for the environment, but it's good for skills, like taking apart something and fixing and putting back together. That's a good population to have instead of just showing up at the Apple store to get your keyboard replaced.
And it's fun.
Yeah. Next question.
Hi, I'm Evelyn, and I'm based in Montreal, and I'd like to really, really thank you for the panel for sharing all this with us. I'm a sound artist. I work with kids in a nonprofit, and we are starting to do our own versions of some of those kits, and also evaluating the possibility of joining an art gallery as a second space so we can do like a commune lab. So that was something I wanted to mention to Mitch. You might want to look into doing an art and hacker space together. It's pretty cool. I had a question for Lady Ada. So I saw those really cool machines, and I was wondering if one of the motivations on getting all these machines and manufacturing your kits here was for ethics reasons, and if you have problems with you know, ethics and sourcing in China, and if there's anything that we can do to be able to produce our own kits without having to source in, you know, already super polluted parts of the world.
Actually, this is something that Mitch, you know a lot about this, so I'm going to defer. I'll answer some, so it's not only on you. But you know, when I bought the machinery to build electronics, honestly, to start because it was running a company, it was just the most efficient way to make sure that I had manufacturing time ability. Like often when you send things out, you're scheduled maybe 6 to 8 weeks with other other people who are renting time on those machines. Essentially, we were making so much that it made sense for me to just buy it and have the quality control in-house, which to me worked out really well. But you know, one of the cool things about having a company is, like Phil mentioned, when you run a company, you run it the way you want to. There's no one rule set. So if I want to have paid family leave, if I want to have election day be a day off, those are decisions that I can make as like the leader of the company. And you know, my idea of what is good for the company is what I can decide to do. And being independent is part of that. If you're independent, you can make the decisions. If you have venture capital or if you're owned by another company, you often don't get to make the decisions. But about manufacturing in China, you actually do a lot of that. And you talked to me about it. Do you want to mention a little bit?
Yeah, so we don't have time anymore. I do manufacture in China, but there are really good manufacturers in China that don't pollute and treat their people well. And you have to go to China to check them out, though, and that's what I did before I hired any. It's important that people, if you're trying to make the world a better place, you don't do that at the expense of others.
Okay.
All right, and that's it. Thank you.